Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Our conversation in depth this hour, and we're talking about the power, the influence, and the visibility of American Black women.
We can't sit back and say that we want safe spaces in public and public places for Black men and be free of police violence, but we are catcalling and harassing and grabbing and sexually assaulting women on the street and making those safe spaces unsafe for them.
That's how this conversation today got started. Michael Denzel Smith was on the show recently to talk about the invisibility of Black men. When we talked about the patriarchy and neglect that Black women have endured for decades, no centuries. So we resolved to have a discussion about it, and that's today. And I want to broaden our scope a little bit. And in the hopes that I hear from you this morning, if you're a young woman of color, African American, Latina, Asian, do you feel like the focus and the energy historically has been so invested in lifting up the men in your community that advancing women has been forgotten or ignored? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Again, I'd ask you to consider this and some of the other themes that'll come up in our conversation. If you're a young woman of color, has a lot of the focus been on lifting up and investing in men in your community that really advancing women has been forgotten or ignored? Online at CarrieMPR, mprnews.org/live, or by phone, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Our guest today, Rhonda Sharp, is president and founder of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race, and she's with us today from Richmond, Virginia. And Rhonda, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Thank you.
Michael Denzel Smith is with us. He's a writer and author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, and he's with us today from New York City. And Michael, welcome back to the show. It's really good to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
I thought we could do a little more refreshing here of how you came to this conclusion. You write in your book that Black men haven't coincidentally put Black women's power and needs second. You say we have done so because we've come to believe in patriarchy and male dominance as the realization of freedom. I think it'd be helpful if you flesh that out a bit more.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have had a movement for the ending of racial oppression since the first Africans were brought to the United States. But so much of it has been focused on, if you look at the way in which the movement has been structured and the things that have been fought for, so much of it is centered on the idea of liberating Black men in hopes of Black men being head of household, breadwinners. The way that it's been framed is that the true injustice of racism in America is that Black men have not had access to economic opportunity to be able to provide for families. They have not had the opportunity to express their full manhood.
Right.
And that's a problem in that what we do then is mimic and reify the idea of patriarchy as a system worthy of mimicking. And we do so to because we are mimicking in a way the structure of a dominant society, right? But what we haven't reckoned with is that that structure doesn't work for anyone. Limits the modes of masculinity and manhood for men to operate within, but it then more importantly limits the opportunities for women, particularly in the context of this, we're talking about women of color, Black women, being subjected to another form of oppression on top of the racialized oppression that's already present, that it's a shared experience, and asking Black women to subdue or to submit or to push their issues aside as if and saying that they are divisive or that they are distraction from the larger project of ending white supremacy and racism in the United States. And so what we have then is this tension whereby over and over again, black women show up to the fight for black men, right? Like every time there is a police officer who shoots and kills a black man, black women show up in the streets. Black women now show up online. They are doing the organizing work. They are doing the intellectual and emotional labor of organizing movements, of building, of doing the everyday work that no one wants to do and it doesn't get recognition in media. They're doing that work over and over again. But when they ask that black men either show up to do the same when the situation is similar for black women, or that they ask black men to examine their own privilege, to examine the ways in which their behavior and language has been harmful and oppressive toward black women, the response is that we simply can't focus on that right now, or that what we're fighting for essentially is the right for black men to do that, because the idea is that the establishment of patriarchy will be liberating.
Let me do this, Michael. I want to take a call and then I want to hear, there was a lot there to take apart and we will. I also want to hear what Rhonda has to say, but to Whitney in Moorhead. Hi, Whitney. What do you think of what you've just heard?
I think there is plenty of voice for women's right and feminism, and it becomes too extreme sometimes with backlash. For example, an infamous YouTuber named Anita Sarkeesi. And there's plenty of voices for regarding racism and stuff, and sometimes those can go too far and cause backlash as far as specific combinations of the two, like for black women, as far as quote-unquote black culture, whether that needs to be addressed, I suppose. But there's lots of issues with black cultures that that extend beyond this issue.
Okay, fair enough. Rhonda, to some of what Michael and then Whitney just said.
I'm not sure how to respond to Whitney's comments, but I want to go back to what you said earlier about women of color responding to men of color in their community, and suggest that this is not just a gender issue within a particular race or ethnicity, but it is also an intra-gender issue.
Intra-gender,
so as,
you said.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because as I think about what Michael is commenting with respect to how black women show up for black women show up for everybody, and not everyone shows back up for us. So if I think, I absolutely agree with everything that he has said about patriarchy. I think that in establishments within the black community, you tend to see that play out more, whether it might be the black church, sometimes on historically black college campuses, where now we're looking and we find that women outnumber black men in terms of enrollment at astounding rates. But you also see it with black women, and I'd say white women. So if you think about the feminist movement, this morning on the Today Show, a woman was interviewing moms, and the conversation was how moms are going to impact the election.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in Wake County, yet the mothers that she were talking to were three white women. Wake County is quite diverse. Mm. So when I think about the invisibility, yet we're talking about moms, and the definition of mom is a white woman, not a black woman was part of that conversation, not a Latino or Hispanic woman, not an Asian woman was part of that conversation. Julianne Malvo used to be the president at Bennett College when I was there. And one of the things that she would say, and I think it goes back to what Michael has written in his book when he talks about all of the movements for black men, whether it's My Brother's Keepers or thinking about when black men were labeled the endangered species. She said, you know, black women tend to implode, right? So you don't necessarily see what's going on with us. And the research that I do, and my co-authors Nina Banks and Cecilia Conrad have a contract to write about black women in the U.S. economy, and we subtitle that The Hardest Working Woman, and we're looking from 1970 moving forward, is to sort of establish some benchmarks, right, about where black women are, where we are with respect to education, what our family structures look like, because we're not part of a conversation. And some of that is the fault of black men. And some of that is the fault of other women who don't necessarily think about it.
Rhonda, I want to concur with that because I was reading economic numbers as I was preparing for the show. Now, we've done many, many shows on equal pay. I didn't know this number, that white women make between 79 and 82 cents for every dollar that white men make. I knew that. Women of color make 65 cents for every dollar that a white American makes. And we've talked a lot about equal pay. And it's even less, by the way, if you're a Latina woman. That's, well, it shouldn't be, but it is a revelation to me. I think when we get numbers like that and we start talking about the economics of this, it goes to what you were just saying. That story's been hidden for a long time.
But Carrie, I think there's another part of that. So again, you made that reference relative to white males. I was very excited to see in Valerie Wilson and William Rogers' report from the Economic Policy Institute in that's looking at the black-white wage gap,
right,
that they reported that not only, I think, black women make 63 cents for every dollar a white male makes, but black women make 80 cents for every dollar that a white woman makes.
Wow.
So from my perspective, when we're talking about pay equity, let's talk about pay equity, right? And that means that it should be equality for everyone, not just this thought that if you bring up white women and their equity, that everyone else will come along. The Allied Social Sciences meetings in Chicago this year, the National Economics Association will have a panel that's going to look at a variety of issues. One panel will be looking at wage inequality for black women. And Charles Betsy, who's a retired professor emeritus at Howard University, has a paper that is going to look at whether or not changes in recessions, you know, this notion that, you know, the tide lifts all boats. What are the implications for black women and men? I'm excited about it because I want to be optimistic that it's going to be positive for black women. But quite often in the work that I do, you will find that things that are plus for black men are not necessarily beneficial for black women. I have some work with Sandy Darity in which someone asked, you know, what are the alternatives for black men in going to college? So why don't you necessarily see them finishing?
Mm-hmm.
And looking at median wages for black men, we found that on average, you know, black men were already making the median household income for the black family with some education. But black women needed to have a college degree to come even close to that, and then there was still disparities. So
yeah,
as we're talking...
I just want to add one more thing to that, Rhonda, and then bring Michael back into this. You mentioned the Economic Policy Institute, another number that they just came out with. 3% of CEOs in America are women of color, and one of the things that the EPI finds that education, as you mentioned, does not level out the opportunity and income gap, and women of color fall deeper into that gap than men of color. And so, Michael, will you come in on this too?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, everything's being said is like quantifiably true. The problem that you run into is why aren't people addressing it? Why aren't people fighting, like making it a part of their advocacy and activism? But when you have people who are committed to the idea of patriarchy, essentially men as head of household, they're not concerned about the wages of black women because what they're fighting for is the economic access of black men because they believe that will take care of everything else. So if you don't subscribe to the idea that women in the workforce is something of value and you don't believe if you devalue black women's labor, if you don't believe that a woman should be working in the first place, then you're not going to be concerned about a wage gap. So there's that. There's the commitment to this idea of a return, essentially, to the heteronormative family structure in which we believe that's what will solve the problems of the black community. And so that then obscures so many different issues, right? So it obscures the ways in which black families are torn apart and have historically been. but then it obscures like same-sex couples, right? Like it doesn't acknowledge them. Then what it does is ask us to fold into a racial justice movement the idea of subservience of women. So we're again limiting the opportunities for women to live full human experiences. Yes, all of this is true. But what's required is a shift in understanding of who matters and who matters and why they matter And so if we don't have that, if we don't have a reckoning with the idea that that our project toward racial justice has not included women because we have believed that they haven't been worthy of inclusion, then we don't shift our perspective and we don't care about these things. And then we keep coming up with the same solutions over and over again that are not solutions.
Michael Denzel Smith is with us this morning. Rhonda Von Shea Sharp is with us today. We're picking up on a discussion that we had a few weeks ago with Michael about his book. And there's a chapter in the book where he talks about his book mainly about the invisibility of men of color, but there's a chapter where he talks about the invisibility of black women. And we promised we'd come back and talk about this again today, that conversation. The book is called Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. Rhonda Sharp with us, president and founder of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. And I'm asking, as you listen to us develop this conversation, if you're a young woman of color, African-American, Latina, Asian, someone called to remind me Native American, do you feel like the focus and the energy historically has been invested in lifting up the men in your community, that advancing women, understanding what some of the economics that we talked about for women of color has really been forgotten or ignored? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Rhonda, I wanted to ask you something about the historic knowledge that we have. I was thinking about the way we celebrate the historical accomplishments of black men. We may only learn about someone like Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King or Adam Clayton Powell Jr. I can't think of a woman of color historically, maybe Harriet Tubman, because she's going on one of our currencies, that whose name would be recognized by most young people in the country. And as I thought about that, I thought, is that because we have this perception that there's only a certain amount of slots that we give to recognizing the accomplishments of people of color, and women fall way down on that list when we're allocating those slots?
I hope not. But okay. As Michael talks about in his book, right, even who he was reading, he had to be challenged to broaden that by a professor in college.
Right.
I would like to think that people will think about Sojourner Truth, right, that she will be a household name for a younger generation, if for no other reason than the association with NASA.
Well, right? Yes, but you want to think that, but is that the case now? I'm not sure it is.
Probably not, right? But I think a lot of that has to do with, again, who's seen and who's not. And women of color are invisible. So your accomplishments, I'm going to take a step back and talk about something that Michael says in his book, mm-hmm. where he's talking about David Chappelle and making the comment that Jelani Cobb says about ownership of your talents and your gifts. And if we think about that, and again, and the way that he's talked about the patriarchal structure in America, whatever black women have done historically, as he points out, Ida B. Wells, or if I think about here in Richmond, Maggie Walker, a lot of the accomplishments that black women have done in particular, and I'm talking about black women, not to ignore anyone else, but I'm going to speak about who I know more about and who looks like me, which are black women, has been a result of something to help themselves or in the defense of a black male. And if the black male has minimum value, then it is going to be really hard for you to have any value, or your value will be placed in the context of the other that you are helping and they take forefront. And so when we think about when Sojourner Truth asked, "Ain't I a woman?" I think, you know, today I still ask that question. I ask that question when I am looking on Twitter for people to follow and the title says woman. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for diversity in the pictures. I don't see it. When I'm looking for conversations, I don't see it. There's a lot of conversation about hidden figures, the women who, the black mathematicians who are at NASA. I think about a young seventh grader named Amina Anike, and hopefully I'm pronouncing Amina's last name correctly, who, you know, did a camp this summer to encourage young girls to have math, you know, confidence around math, and watching the mothers cry because their daughters don't have that confidence. And I am looking for information to share with these young girls about other black female mathematicians, including, you know, myself, because technically my PhD is in mathematics. When you think about, and I said this the last time I was on your show, I think a lot of it has to do with the narrative. If you are not valued, then your accomplishments aren't valued and no one thinks to report them.
Michael?
Yeah, I think probably the two most celebrated black women in like the overarching narrative of American history are like Harriet Tubman and Rosa Parks, right? And they serve like very particular functions within that narrative. So Harriet Tubman is used as an exemplar of bravery. We don't want to discuss what she was being brave in the face of, but we want to talk about the bravery and courage of Harriet Tubman and use that as an inspirational model for other people to be courageous. And then Rosa Parks, the most recent example would again, an example of courage and bravery, but also an example of proper womanhood in so many ways, right? Like, or what's defined as proper womanhood. Because we take again that time period and remember that she's not the first to make that stand on the bus, not the first to make it in that city. But because of the strictures of understanding who would be a sympathetic figure, Rosa Parks as a middle-aged black woman, church-going, quiet, and all of these things that you can ascribe to her character becomes this symbol of the movement and what people are fighting for, right? We're fighting for the protection of our black women on these buses. That's initially, right? Like even then, it's sort of like in this weird space where it becomes like black men need to step up and fight the man because look what they're doing to our women. But then what it shifts to is the movement becomes about the rights of men, right? It becomes about these charismatic black right. male figures. It becomes about Dr. King because that's what we always do is shift it to what these accomplishments of black women always lead to us talking about the ways in which that impacts black men. So like we can talk about like the work of Ida B. Wells and the documentation of lynching, and it should be celebrated, it should be lauded, and we should continue to talk about it. But the thing is that we do so in part because lynching is so closely associated with the plight of black men. So what she did was in service of black men. So we're not talking about necessarily the intellectual contributions of an Anna Julia Cooper who talks specifically about black women in the South, right? So just what I'm getting at is that we have certain figures that we celebrate so long as they are in the service of one, either American exceptionalism mm-hmm. or the narrative of the endangered black men and the ways in which black women have been in service to them.
Rhonda, you think that's right?
I think he's correct. And I think that the other side of that, when he's talking about Anna Julia Cooper, I don't think many of us would know about her
right.
had it not been for Melissa Harris Perry, who has a center at Wake Forest named after her, bringing her to the forefront. So I think, you know, as we're talking about Black women historically that we don't know about. I think some of that, and I am hopeful that there's a generation, and I guess it's a note to self as well, to bring more of those women to the forefront, to have conversations with folks, to be mindful that when we're talking about Black history, that should be inclusive of men and women, and more importantly, when we're talking about women's history, that we should be talking about all women who have contributed, not just, as I believe it tends to be, white women, but that there are Black women and Hispanic women and Native American women and Asian women who have also contributed, who need to be celebrated. And I think that that's a responsibility of all of us.
Can I ask you both for, I know this has not been addressed in a really enlightening way in the presidential campaign. But I do have to ask you both about the way this came up in the debate, the economics and the lack of advancement and opportunity for Americans of color, and the way Donald Trump phrased this. So I want to just pull an excerpt here and have you listen to this.
We have a situation where we have our inner cities, African-Americans, Hispanics, are living in hell because it's so dangerous. You walk down the street, you get shot. We have to protect our inner cities because African-American communities are being decimated by crime.
Rhonda, does that reflect your understanding of, well, he's specifically mentioning Hispanic and African-American Americans?
I think he greatly exaggerated, but let me also say on the other side, and there's a Wall Street Journal article that talks about women of color in corporate America, in which Hillary has made the comment about the glass ceiling being shattered. And in this article in particular, women of color talk about it's great that you can break the glass ceiling, but for us, it's a concrete ceiling. You need a door to get through that. So you know, I think that we need to be mindful that both candidates are probably out of touch. You know, Donald is worth $4.5 billion in estimated net worth, and Hillary's $30.1 million net worth. Both of the candidates grew up elite and privileged. So what's happening in the inner city and what the ills are, I would argue neither one really has a pulse on what's going on in the inner city and what are the ills of people of color.
Michael?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard out here, but like just walking down the street, like that seems to be like an exaggeration. But I was disappointed in both of their answers because what happened, I mean, the question itself was sort of lend itself to these very vapid answers.
Kind of generalized, sweeping generalizations,
yeah.
Agreed.
So in asking about sort of like this, what I feel like is just a useless term, and like how are we addressing race relations?
Right.
What's the question? Like, how are you addressing the question about race? It's neither of those things. Like, what we're talking about is a system of racism, right? And so what that question then allowed them to do was open up this space in which they Hillary started talking about, you know, criminal justice reform, but then like moved into the question about like crime and like basically like doing sort of even-handedness and bringing in black-on-black crime, essentially, like if you're listening carefully enough. And neither want to then address like the underlying causes of that crime, right? Like neither want to address the mechanisms for fixing it that have to do with historic divestment from Black communities in terms of education, in terms of housing, in terms of economic security. No one brought up the fact that the water in Flint is still poisoned. You know, I mean, things like that happen every single day that are systemic problems that are born of one market ideology in which the private sector will fix everything for us, but that hitting hardest in Black communities because the initial divestment happens there because Black people are America's experiment. Both of their answers are inadequate, but Donald again like shows the ways in which like he appears more dangerous through the use of his rhetoric because he says things like Black people just walk down the street and get shot. I mean, no one that just doesn't happen.
So, Rhonda, one last point about this. The questions, and maybe this is just the structure of political debate, but the questions seem to focus on, I think, the extremes and often about crime. Where are the questions about the economic opportunity and some of the numbers that we've all talked about this morning, and pressing on the candidates to really give something, you know, indicating that they've actually thought about this? You don't hear that come up very often in these political discussions.
We are in agreement on that, and I'm going to come back that in just a second and go back to what Michael said about Flint. And what I like to say about the water is what I understand in third world countries, the notion of collecting water is a woman's job. When I think about Flint and the fact that there is not water, I often hear again the mothers talking about the ways in which they have to be careful to bathe their children or feed their children. And again, you know, this is in America, in which we have something that parallels what we see in third world countries in terms of not having water. And that is a burden on women. And in Flint, it's again a burden on women of color that we're not having a conversation about. With respect to the questions about economics and what the numbers are, I would be very surprised if you have real questions, because if you have a real conversation about economic numbers, the inequality in the U.S., I think it goes back to what Michael has been saying. It would be really hard to have those conversations, honest, true conversations, without having conversations about the ways in which racism is part of the fabric of the United States and very much woven into the infrastructure with respect to education and employment. And I don't think that either side really wants to have a conversation about that, because that's always, you know, generally our dirty little secret about racism that no one really wants to have an open, honest conversation about, except for the folks who are impacted by the racist policies.
Rhonda Michael, thank you very much for coming back to talk to us again.
Thank you for having me, Kay.
Thank you.